Because God forbid, like I'd be so annoyed if 40 years from now the museums talk about, oh yeah, we had like, Salma Bakery used to exist here, like we had the Boss and Maxim's and they're gone now. That's too bad. And I'm like, well, where were you in 2024? Where were you to do this? Like people that push tourism really like to romanticize like the past and the lasting image of what the past was. But people that push tourism don't actually try to keep the culture alive right now. And they act like the culture's all gone, which is a lie. And yeah, I'm gonna cap it there on my thoughts.
I would say just to add on that, it's an element of classism too that I hear specific generations kind of repeat, like, oh, our back in the days we were discriminated against, and now I can enter a profession, and so like I want to distance myself from it. So I find like a lot of the institutions that are there, like the Chinese Canadian Museum and the Chinese Chinatown Storytelling Center, they're like talking of, positioning themselves as here's the history of success, here's the history of contribution, and then distancing themselves or remaking a Chinatown in a very classist way that doesn't recognize the residents, especially the low-income residents who are there. So I think there's an element of that going on too. That's not to say like we do have tourists come to our events. They are anywhere from 5% to 20% of our event attendees at any given time. They often remark that we're sometimes the best experience that they have out of all of the cultural offerings in Chinatown. So it's really a balance between serving the community first, but also recognizing that tourism is part of the neighborhood in many ways. What's so fascinating is like some people would be like, oh, it's really interesting coming to Chinatown together events because they're like very different from the events that happen that people know of, which is like the Chinatown Festival hosted by the Chinatown Business Improvement Association, Light Up Chinatown hosted by Chinatown Foundation. There's also a Mid-Autumn Festival that's hosted by the Sun Yat-sen Garden. And folks would be like, there's no Chinese food even. Like, why are there lobster rolls and pizza? And just like there's something just weird about it, even though there are lanterns everywhere and this kind of purport of showcasing Chinese culture. And I would argue is that what is weird is that they are sort of like this gateway to gentrification because they are the supporters of gentrification. So a lot of what they showcase is sort of like an orientalized version of Chinese culture of Chinatown, and is what the white gaze wants, right? It's like Chinese Canadian culture under the white gaze. And so it's not necessarily like a completely, outsider gentrifier presenting this version of copycat Chinese culture that they completely don't understand and is just extracting from, but is definitely something that is a gateway towards that by demonstrating Chinese culture under a white gaze that is susceptible to, white gaze and white folks. And by that, gentrifies the neighborhood and appropriates our culture at the end of the day. Whereas for Chinatown Together, we want to with that, like, that's not what we're about. We're about like really authentically reliving and revitalizing our culture and neighborhood and centering the people who hold that cultural knowledge, which is our elders, to be able to pass it on from one generation to another.
Thank you both for your very eloquent and also beautiful responses to my question. I think it's kind of like this decades long horrible nightmare of a story where it's like, how long are, quite frankly, how much longer are some of our peers, some of our Chinese peers, going to continue to uphold this model minority myth, right? Of like pulling up your bootstraps and disassociating yourselves with people who you might not, you know, who like wealthy people might not find very acceptable. At the very end of the day, to the white person, you are still an outsider. You're not, you know, we can use these labels to call ourselves Chinese Canadian. We are not ever going to be Canadian, not only because there are layers, settler colonial layers to that, right? But we are not going to be these fully westernized white people. So like, you know, why continue to try to remove yourselves from that? Why continue to try to remove yourselves from the space also that, like, is not only, like, really racialized, but also very classed? You can't, it's hard to try to separate those two things, right? There is a reason why Chinatown has the classed makeup and demographic that it does. And guess what, buddy? Like, a lot of your ancestors started there, right? That's where they started. There's no point in trying to whitewash that. That issue about tourism, right? That thing about, you know, Chinatown is dead and whatnot. Have either of you been to the Victoria Chinatown? Yeah.
Yes, I have.
You'll know what I mean then. Victoria's Chinatown, my dear listener, if you have not been there already, when you go there as a Chinese person, this is what you will notice. This is a place for tourists, definitely tourists, and there are no Chinese people. There are so few. I went there just last month for fun. I hadn't been to Victoria's Chinatown before, but I knew that, you know, it's one of the oldest Chinatowns in so-called North America. I was like, yeah, I'm really excited to go. And I get there, and I think there are really maybe less than 10 businesses that seem to be Chinese-owned, that seem to be owned by residents. And when I looked around me, almost all of the people were tourists. I could barely find somebody who looks like me who was a tourist. And I couldn't hear Chinese being spoken on the street. And it was an isolating experience. It felt weird because all around me there are these little placards and signs from the Museum of BC History and stuff like that, talking about the school that used to be there, the business that used to be there, the family that used to own these businesses, this place where people used to play games and mahjong and stuff like that, this part of the town where all the sailors came in and all that. But I couldn't feel that those places were lived in, because the people who now are in those spaces, they are not, quite frankly, they're not my people. Right? And whenever I think about that experience, it makes me feel so deeply grateful for organizations such as Chinatown Together, because it goes back to exactly what you guys are talking about. Like, Vancouver's Chinatown, it is extremely lively. What it is racialized. What it is classed. And when people talk about how this place is dead, we need to really ask ourselves, dead to who? Right? Why would you think that this place is dead? Is it because, like, you don't hear English being spoken everywhere? Why do you think this place is dead? Is it because, like, you don't see a lot of people who look like you? One of the most populous racialized, or one of the most places in Vancouver that are most populated by racialized people. Why are we talking about this idea that it's dead, and we need to revitalize it with tourism. Why do we need to not to be rude, why do we need to fill it with people who are not us when it is, there's a reason why Chinatown exists, right? And yeah, you know, I just like constantly, really, I gotta say this again, listener, if I have not convinced you already, if Gal and Melody have not convinced you already, like, Chinatown together is really the bomb.com. That's really what it is. And the reason why is because, like, we're putting Chinese people first at this organization to make sure that Chinese folks are not being lost in the rest of the garbage of Vancouver, in this place that is increasingly unaffordable and increasingly trying to, you know, for whatever reason, trying to filter out the color and the spice of this place that's apparently supposed to be so multicultural.
I went to Victoria for the first time maybe a few years ago, and I was so excited to check out what their Chinatown was like, because I've only known, like, Vancouver Chinatown. And I will say it was a culture shock, because how I describe Victoria's Chinatown to people is that it is very sanitized of culture. And I feel like that's all I have to say. And with regards to, like, like what you said about Chinatown together putting, like, Chinese people first, yes. And also, we put Chinese people that are not deemed palatable enough first. And that's super important, because I know some people be like, well, I put Chinese people first. And, like, you put Chinese people that are financially beneficial to you, through nepotism or through you know, networking, that are beneficial, that are palatable, that are, again, like Melody said, like, serve the white gaze.
Young. They're often, yeah, young.
Yeah.
Super young.
Yeah. Or, you know, some people are middle aged and they should know better. I actually think that these individuals should know better. I believe that they, you know, have that intellect to know better, and they choose not to, which I think makes it more sinister that they know better and choose not to. And yeah, I'm gonna leave it off there. I could, like, go on, and we'd be here for, like, another 3 hours. Oh, I'm a cat.
Yeah, on Victoria's Chinatown. So I've been there as a kid. I've been there about 10, 15 years ago, and then I was there last year. And it's changed. Like, in Fantan Alley, when I was a kid, there used to be a place where I loved, where they had, like, you know, the Chinese ear pickers, and it's, like, owned by a Chinese person, and the whole place was, like, very much lively with Chinese culture, Chinese shops, Chinese people. Then I went there at the beginning of gentrification, about 10, 15 years ago, I would say. Where their first condo project came in that wasn't oriented towards the community. And what's interesting is someone told me the difference between Victoria's Chinatown and Vancouver's Chinatown is that the gentrification is done a little bit different. In Victoria's Chinatown, it's very integrated into the urban aesthetic of the place. So Fantan Alley might still be there. It still might look like a Chinese-owned shop, but then you go in there and it's like a white person selling crystals, right? Whereas Vancouver's Chinatown, they tell you they're gentrifying the place. They recolor a bright turquoise building into black or white, right? They rip out the signage or appropriate the signage. They tear down buildings and put up million-dollar condos, literally, that are concrete and glass. So the gentrification is more pronounced and more harsh, whereas Victoria's, you kind of have to look around a little bit and be like, oh, there's something really weird here. I would say I would have the same experience for Washington, D.C.'s Chinatown. The first time I went there, I was like, wow, is this a Disneyland version of Chinatown that they just created? Because it looked, you know, why is there Hooters with Chinese signage? And a cafe with Chinese signage, or like a gym that literally says Taiyokun, like just gym in Chinese, versus like the name of the place. It's because the city council at that time thought that to save Chinatown after they put in a massive stadium there was to ask all the businesses to put Chinese signage, and it would solve everything. But obviously it hasn't, and the population of Chinese folks like significantly decreased. Same thing with Mexico City's Chinatown. There's no Chinese folks there, very few, and Cuba's Chinatown, and those places have definitely reoriented, like their Chinatown has been reoriented to a tourism Chinatown where there aren't any Chinese people. So, I hope that Vancouver's Chinatown don't get there. And through Chinatown Together, we hope that young folks, young kids who participate in our event will eventually take up the torch and continue the intangible cultural aspect of Chinatown through events and other initiatives.
We've had a really lovely conversation here today on Typically Tuesdays. You're tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM. I'm Leslie, and I've been talking with the co-founders of Chinatown Together, Gal and Melody. We're just talking a lot about Chinatown and culture and anti-gentrification. And this is a topic that I'm sure that you're interested in, my dear listener, because you have stuck around for this long. Before we end off the show today, Gal and Melody, tell me about Chinatown Together's upcoming schedule and where people can find out more, and how people can stay connected with and support Chinatown Together.
For sure. Our upcoming events, July 28th, we have a mini night market. That's right, the Chinatown Night Market is coming back under Chinatown Together in mini form for now. And we will have a film screening in the second half. And we're going to have a short film, episode one of In Chinatown, that features Sean from Shaolin. And then the feature film is Shaolin Soccer. It's a fan favorite, cult classic. Please come down. Please enjoy. We're going to have food vendors, seniors mini market, a few extra vendors. We're going to have a Beyblade competition. And from the Instagram comments, I've realized that the Beyblade competition is going to be the highlight of all of this, apparently.
Yeah, I'm so excited for the mini night market and the film night. Just because my vision for Chinatown Together is that one day we'll be able to host the Chinatown Night Market again, which I opened when it first opened. And I have a lot of childhood memories and nostalgic memories about that. So if other people aren't going to do it and Richmond's night market is closing down, I think it's time for Chinatown to shine. How people can keep in touch with us. We have an Instagram account at Chinatown Together where you'll see all of our events, our past events, as well as upcoming events. We also have a spicy newsletter that I run called Save ChinatownYBR.org. So it not only mentions Chinatown Together's events, but also just things that are happening in Chinatown. I like to call it kind of like the gossip column a bit of Chinatown, where you'll just get spicy opinions about gentrification and injustice that Gail and I are frustrated about, that is a little bit outside of what we would present on Instagram, which is a bit more milquetoast. So I would say those are the main two channels. And if you come to our events, which we encourage everybody to do, you will always hear about the next event.
That's awesome. Yeah, actually, music coordinator of CJSF, Connor, and I, we were just talking a few weeks ago about the local night markets, and we were just getting really nostalgic about the old Chinatown one, because that is actually what a night market is like in Asia, right? Like those, in he spent quite a bit of time in Asia, living there as well. he was like, the one in Richmond, you know, not to be rude or anything, but the one in Richmond is just like, really just like, ugh. It's a, you know, it's a money game over there. So really excited to hear about the mini night market coming up, and of course about Big Fight, Little Chinatown. As well, I was actually wondering, are you looking for volunteers?
Always. We actually, people go to our Instagram Chinatown Together, and then go to our Linktree. Link is in the bio. There is a volunteer submission form. If they submit their little email in there, I will send out regular volunteer call outs, and folks, if they're available, can reply to that email and say, yeah, I'd like to volunteer, and then there you go. Simple as that.
Awesome.
Chinatown Together is powered by volunteers. So, if anybody wants to help and get even deeper into the community, we welcome you.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Gal and Melody, for your time, and thank you for all of your thoughts and wisdom about Chinatown and anti-gentrification and cultural revitalization. It's very much, very, very much needed. We, again, don't want to end up like DC nor Victoria. Check out Chinatown Together's events by checking out their Instagram and newsletter. And yeah, thank you so much again.
Thank you so much, Leslie. Thanks for holding space for us.
Thank you for having us on today.
This is Bird Note. In nature, things aren't always black or white, male or female. There have been sightings of cardinals that are red on one side and brown on the other, indicating a bird that is half male and half female. This anomaly occurs in other species of birds as well, not just cardinals. Scientists call these birds bilateral gynandromorphs, known informally as half-siders. Birds' sex chromosomes are different from those of mammals. Male mammals have one of each sex chromosome, an X and a Y. Female mammals have two X chromosomes, but in birds, this is reversed. The female has two different sex chromosomes, while the male has two of the same. So, if a bird's egg develops with two intact nuclei, this second nucleus can also be fertilized. It's sort of like when you get a chicken egg with two yolks. But in this case, it's like the yolks have fused, and the result of these fused embryos is a chick that's half male and half female, just like that half red and half brown cardinal. As far as we know, half-siders do not reproduce. Check out a photo of a half-sider cardinal on our website, birdnote.org. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
Really interesting insights there about nature from our friends over at Bird Note. You know, just goes to show you that, in fact, the natural world is not as binary as we've understood it to be and what some people insist that it is. In fact, it is much more diverse, and the natural world, the natural order thrives on diversity. Hey, you're tuned in to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Leslie. Really quickly, just before we wrap up the show and, you know, just talking about diversity and all that, here's a really quick reminder that Typically Tuesdays Pride Special episode is going to air in just a few weeks. And this year, I am asking you how you are resisting against, you know, the corporatization of pride, rainbow washing, pink washing, homo nationalism, by building bridges of solidarity with your fellow queer people and building bridges of solidarity with other people who are also oppressed and marginalized. Community is the essence of resistance, as we've talked about a lot today and last week on the program. And this is just another way of looking at it from a queer perspective, I think. I really want to be able to highlight the voices of queer folks in my community, in typically Tuesday's community, I guess, and show that, in fact, you cannot beat us, you cannot put us down. Doesn't matter how corporatized pride would get, we will always find a way to resist until we reach liberation. The forum for you to contribute your thoughts is still open. You can find it over on the link in my bio on Instagram. I'm at Typically Tuesdays. You can also find the link to that on any archived episode of Typically Tuesdays since late June over on cjsf.ca if you don't have Instagram. I want this show to be able to express to any listener of the program that, in fact, like, queer people are very strong in numbers. And also, you know, I want to, you know, the media side of things, you know, I want to kind of like highlight a type of queer experience that mainstream media refuses to highlight, which is queer resistance. Hello, get into it. Anyways, the forum is going to be open until Friday, August 2nd. And the show is going to air Monday, August 5th. So you still have some time, if you're interested, to share your thoughts and contribute to this project. And I really, 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 really would love it if you would. I'd be very grateful if you do. So please go check that out over on the link in my Instagram at Typically Tuesdays. And share about it as well. I'd be really grateful if you could help me get the word out on that special project and on Typically Tuesdays also. Thank you in advance, and I hope to read your response soon. Closing off the show today, I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Typically Tuesdays. Thank you so much for tuning in. I have been dying to get Gal and Melody onto the program for a while, actually, and also dying to talk to them about talk to anybody, really, about the gentrification of Victoria's Chinatown. You know, going there, I don't do traveling pretty much at all, going there was extremely jarring, and I'm not gonna lie, it made me feel extremely alienated, right? I just worry sometimes that 10, you know, 15 years from now, Vancouver's Chinatown is going to look something very similar, where I don't get to hear Chinese being spoken around me in that area as much. I won't get to see as many Chinese-owned businesses. I won't get to see that many Chinese people hanging around over there. And organizations such as Chinatown Together and other ones who are doing very similar work show me that even if that's going to happen, no matter when it's going to happen, there will always be a fight. And folks aren't going to sit down and just take it. Because there's a lot of spirit in Chinatown, a lot of life, and a lot of love in Chinatown. Resistance is kind of the essence of this place. I mean, when you think about it, right? The history of Chinatown and why those places exist. Resistance is key. Love and community is key. Survival. And really what I think a lot of the folks over at Chinatown Together, including Gal and Melody, what they're trying to do is, you know, they're trying to invoke that kind of ancestral pride and legacy and spirit. It's a really cool thing to see. And I hope you're like me and you continue to stay engaged and in tune with what's happening over in Vancouver's Chinatown, and you will continue to support initiatives such as Chinatown Together to help resist against gentrification and stoke cultural revitalization. And so here's also where I'm going to sign off today. Thank you so much for tuning in to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you for your continued support. And thank you for giving a damn about what people on radio have to say.
please go check out the Typically Tuesdays Pride special project over on my Instagram. I'll talk to you very soon. Next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening